The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 26th day of April, after which I'll hand it off to Derek Wozniak and John Sweeney for hour number two. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is right across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the Hoops Hall of Famer, star of the ABA and NBA, the A-Train, the great artist Gilmore, will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to four-time Stanley Cup winning defenseman from the great New York Islanders dynasty. Dave Langevin will be with us. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great talk ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by and give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at SportsTalk1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest was a star center during his two-year collegiate career at Jacksonville University, located down in Jacksonville, Florida, of course. He led the Dolphins to the NCAA Division I championship game in 1970. He went on to star in the ABA and then in the NBA and was elected to the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame in Springfield, Mass. In 2011. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the A-Train himself, Artis Gilmore. Artis, good evening.
Good afternoon.
It's great to have you with us.
Totally. It's good to be with you.
Now, Artis, you were born in a town called Shipley, Florida. It's up in the Panhandle, Washington County. Tell us a little bit what it was like growing up in Shipley and then in Dothan, Alabama.
Well, actually, I was born and basically raised in Shipley, Florida. And, of course, Dothan, Alabama is north about 30 miles or less to the Alabama, the city of Dothan, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually just graduated from that, from a local, a black institute school, high school in Dothan. So a majority of my life and youth was spent in a small town, as you mentioned earlier, Shipley, Florida.
Now, growing up in that type of environment, were you exposed to a lot of pro basketball? What teams did you root for, or who were your favorite players?
Bill, that was a long time ago. In fact, technology and the interest of sports was at a minimum.
Okay, yeah.
Once every when time would permit and it was available, would have a chance to watch. Mostly it was the game of the week with Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain, the 76ers and the Boston Celtics competing against each other.
Sure, yeah. Who wouldn't, right? Who wouldn't watch those guys now? You played at Gardner-Webb Junior College for 2 years, then on to Jacksonville. Now, you went to that NCAA title game, Artis, in 1970. You lost to UCLA, but I'd have to say Jacksonville playing against UCLA, that was a pretty big step, wasn't it?
Well, it was just an extraordinary Cinderella run.
Yeah.
For Jacksonville University and that the entire experience was pretty special for the community and the city and in fact for the entire state of Florida.
Now that was a ball club for folks that don't know. Of course, Coach Wooden was leading UCLA. They had Sidney Wicks, Curtis Rowe, Henry Bibby and the late Steve Patterson on that ball club. That was before Bill Walton got there and Jamal Wilkes and guys like that. But still, a very formidable ball club, wasn't it, Artis?
No question about it. Very challenging. And Coach Wooten had some players who've had a chance to compete at that level for a number of years. And certainly I think the experience and with his under his leadership was able to guide them to a championship a game against Jacksonville Dolphins.
And they went on to play pros, a lot of those ball players.
Yes, a number of those guys. Henry Bibby, as you mentioned. I think Steve Patterson played a little bit. And, of course, Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe, all of those guys played for a number of years in the league.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, while at Jacksonville, Artis, I believe you were one of five college players ever to average 20 points and 20 rebounds over your career.
Yes, that was a pretty impressive statistic. And, you know, certainly I look back and acknowledge that what a pretty special accomplishment.
And you led the NCAA in rebounding both years. And your career average of 22.7 is still the highest in NCAA Division I history.
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't followed statistics that closely. So, you know, if you have that, if that's a record, you know, I just sit back and admire.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would. And that's a fact, folks. 22.7 rebounds per game. That's the highest in NCAA Division I history. And that belongs to our guest tonight, Artis Gilmore. Now, when you departed Jacksonville, Artis, you were drafted by the Kentucky Colonels and by the Chicago Bulls in the 1971 draft. What made you go the way of the ABA instead of the NBA?
Well, because of the guarantees, the funds.
Okay.
Naturally, from my departure and growing up in a very large family and the like of so many things, and certainly that you know, those thoughts was under consideration, and knowing that having an idea that I would be able to share and do some things with the family.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you certainly made the right decision in my book, because what kid didn't love the ABA growing up? I remember that succinctly. What kid didn't love the red, white, and blue ball and the three-point shot and everything that went along with the excitement of ABA basketball, the offensive wizardry of all the guys that played in the ABA? Now, 71-72 was your first year with Kentucky. You had Joe Mullaney as your coach, who, by the way, for the local folks listening, was a graduate of Chaminade High School right here in Mineola, Long Island. And you played with some great ball players on that club, some great names in the old ABA that I love to recall. Dan Issel, a Hall of Famer, Louis Dampier, who made it into the Hall of Fame this year, and you were Rookie of the Year and MVP in your rookie year.
Yes.
Not
as a pretty special year for me.
Definitely. Well, tell us, see if you could recall a little bit for us about the rookie year.
Well, as you indicated, it happened to be a pretty special year. I played next to Dan Issel and Louis Dampier, who had a tremendous career. And also, as you indicated, this year, been nominated and will be inducted this fall into the Hall of Fame. So, mm-hmm. You know, you had three, and that would mean that we had three Hall of Famers on the same team. So that was that particular year under the leadership of Joe Mullaney. You know, I think we won 60-something ball games and lost 14. So it was a good ride, and of course we kind of lost our rhythm going into the playoffs and was not able to extend that.
Right. You ended up losing to the Nets. I'll do my homework. I saw that. You lost to the Nets. Now, this wasn't the Dr. J Nets. This was the Louis Karnisekin Nets, the pre-Dr. J Nets with Rick Barry. And you went up against, I guess you were playing against the likes of Billy Paltz and Gino Moore and Jim Ard, Manny Leakes, guys like that.
Right, right. Absolutely. And they were able to come in and knock the Colonels off and a surprise, really took advantage of it. They came in and played again under the leadership of Rick Barry. Rick Barry, of course, went on in 1975 and led the Golden State Warriors to an NBA title. So, yes, that's correct, Luke Karnisekin.
That was a surprise to you guys then to get knocked off by the Nets.
Yeah,
I can
absolutely
imagine. Yeah. Now, one of the great names you did play with in Kentucky, artists that I was looking up, was Wendell Ladner, a great ABA name. Tell us a little bit about Wendell Ladner, one of the unique guys. He played for the Nets as well that we remember around here.
Well, Wendell was just a very tough competitor, and he, you know, he was just a really physical player, and you know that when he's on the floor, you can expect him to go all out, diving on the floor of loose balls, just a regular crash individual. And I remember thinking back a few years later on, he was killing a Eastern Airline plane accident.
Right.
And because of his toughness, he thought perhaps it, you know, if anybody would walk away from a plane crash, it would have been Wendell Ladner.
Yeah, exactly. He was a real enforcer type, wasn't he, Artis?
Enforcer, that's the terminology everybody looks for.
Yeah, he protected guys like Dr. J, Dan Issel, on the court.
Right. I had a chance to play with them for a few years, a couple of years, and then and certainly against them with the Nets.
And, yeah, great man, the late Wendell Ladner. Now, in 74-75 with Kentucky, new coach comes in, guy named Hubie Brown, and takes the Colonels to the championship.
Yeah, Hubie was one of the assistant coaches up in Milwaukee and certainly came out and took over the Colonels, and he was able to do some things to help us focus a little bit better and execute and do things that was necessary in order to allow us that opening to win the championship in 1975.
Now, that was a year that you did knock off the Nets of Kevin Lockery with Dr. J and that assorted cast of, I guess, Larry Keenan, Billy Paltz, and John Williamson. How tough was Dr. J? I consider Dr. J, artist, probably the greatest open court player that I've ever seen. I mean, he was operating way before Michael Jordan. I that's what I tell the younger kids that I see. He was doing it before Michael was, in my opinion. What do you think about that?
Well, there's no question. Julius was just a phenomenal talent, and he understood a very smart and intelligent basketball player. So he was able to execute and do things on the floor that earlier players, great players like Connie Hawkins and Elgin Baylor, those type players, mm-hmm. The way they handled the ball on the floor. So he was very entertaining and exciting to watch.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the name Connie Hawkins. That's another great name from ABA, NBA lore artists.
Yes.
Connie Hawkins, yeah, great one. Now, in 75-76, the Colonels sink a little bit. Do you feel that, artist, is because the trade of Dan Issel to the Baltimore Claws takes place, later to be the Denver Nuggets? Do you think that the exit of ISIL has to do with the downfall of the colonels?
Well, there's no question. There was a missing little spot there when Dan Issel moved on. But obviously there were some other things that was going on behind the scenes, and that certainly I didn't have privilege information to inside the walls of the management.
Understood. Okay. Now, with the merger, you were the number one draft pick when the NBA, the dispersal draft, the from the ABA to the NBA. What was the different feel to you of the NBA versus the ABA when you went to the Chicago Bulls?
Well, obviously the difference is we had different venues to play in, whereas before and the ABA, we had a number of venues, like on a college campus, Butler, and we played San Diego State, and a few other locations was kind of a college environment, whereas and once the NBA and the NBA merged, the venue, they had their own arenas and fans, and a little bit more, quite a bit more media attention.
Definitely, yeah, good point. More stadiums and definitely bigger media crowd, yeah. And you got to cross paths with a few of your old teammates, Larry Keenan, guys like that with the Chicago Bulls. You did succeed in Chicago. You had five or six good years. How did you feel about leaving Chicago Artists and going on to San Antonio?
Well, initially, I was a little surprised that the decision was made to move on. But once the transition happened, I was really honored to play with a great player like George Gervin, and of course, in a city like San Antonio, it was, of course, a lot different than what it is today. You know, but we had tremendous success. Not quite as much as they've had since my departure from there, but we had success.
Right. It was a better ball club. Stan Olbeck, from what I've heard from past guests, Stan Olbeck was a good coach.
Stan was a very good coach, and it was a little surprising when he decided to move up and take a job with the Nets.
Yeah. The guys that I heard he was a good coach were former netball players. I believe it was Otis Birdsong had sung the praises, no pun intended, of Stan Olbeck.
So, yes.
We're speaking to Artis Gilmore tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You were an all-star twice in San Antonio, Artis. Then you headed back to Chicago. What sent you back to Chicago? You played for Doug Collins over there. What made you go back to Chicago?
Well, obviously, I done used up my welcome in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And then moving on. Back to San Antonio, moving on back to Chicago for half of the year, and then back.
Right. Well, you got a chance to play with some great ball players back in your second run back in Chicago. You played with Jordan, Oakley, Paxson, Horace Grant, Pippen, Rory Sparrow. Tell us a little bit about playing with Michael Jordan.
Well, he was a very talented player, and he was working on putting it all together for the time. I think he was like in his fourth year and had won three straight scoring titles, and he was doing it all. He just he was learning how to work with others, and so that was the difference for him.
Yeah, he was only scratching the surface back then, right, Artis?
Yes.
And that was back when he had he had Scottie Pippen, but he had Horace Grant, Charles Oakley. He didn't have the full supporting cast that he would later win the championship. And Doug Collins was at the helm. What did you think of Doug Collins as the coach back then?
Well, I didn't have that much of a coaching experience. I mean, with him. I was only there for just a half of the year, and then
right.
the remaining half of the year with the Celtics.
So, right. You did get to end the career in a great place, your NBA career anyway, with the Celtics and Casey Jones, another great ball club with some great Hall of Famers, some of the NBA 50 greatest ball players, Larry Bird, Kevin McHale. With the Chief, Robert Parrish. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with the Boston Celtics, Artis.
Well, for the first time, I had really experienced what a franchise means, what it takes. They're willing to do whatever it takes to win. They make the sacrifice. They take care of their athletes and the players, and they're dedicated to and they certainly understood what it take, to put the tools in the player's hand to allow them to be successful.
Now, you attribute that to just the Celtics organization.
Well, was the first that organization, absolutely.
Yeah, because I was speaking last week. We had Dikembe Mutombo on. And he was mentioning that all players should get a chance to play in a place like either Boston, New York, Los Angeles, or Philadelphia, where the fans or the organizations are top-notch to get an experience like that. And here you mentioned Boston. So I guess you guys know what you're talking about.
Well, absolutely. That's what it's about. When you allow your athletes to have whatever it takes, you're willing to provide for them whatever it takes to be successful. And,
good point.
You're not, yeah.
Now, what made you want to go to Italy, Artis, to play a year over there?
Well, obviously, it sounded like it appears that my career was done in the NBA, and it was an opportunity. I felt like I could still play, and I certainly wanted to provide an experience, a cultural experience for my family. So I made that choice to go to Italy for a year.
And you certainly did provide that. That's a great idea to provide that for your family, to take them over Italy for a year. And you certainly succeeded over there. You made the All-Star team. You scored 12.3 points a game, 11 rebounds. And how was the style of play different in Italy than you found it in the NBA?
Well, God, it was different. They could play the zone. The out-of-bounds play, knocking the ball off the rim. The rules were a little different.
Yeah.
And the lane, just the lane with that pyramid type.
Yeah. Yeah, that's strange. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes.
Who did you find, Artis, your toughest battles on the court with in the ABA and in the NBA? Who did you have your toughest battles with in the middle there?
Everybody. You mentioned Billy Paulus was a tough challenge for me. I had always to play against Caldwell Jones, who Maurice Lucas.
Tough guy, yeah.
Tough players, man. And then there was Kareem, there was Bob Lanier, Dave Collins, and, of course, Dan Issel again. Bill Walton, when he was healthy, was just a tremendous player.
Great names. Now, being inducted into Springfield, Artis, was that the pinnacle for you?
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's the pinnacle of the game. You've reached the highest point, which is the level of being actually inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's a great place. I love going up there. I really enjoy it. It's It's interactive for the kids, and it's really a wonderful experience. You're now working at your alma mater in Jacksonville, and you're very involved in the community as well, aren't you?
Absolutely. Working with Mayor, we hoping to get our Mayor Brown, Alvin Brown, reelected for another term, and certainly working with him as also, as you indicated, Jacksonville University. Just a tremendous experience.
So you can go home again, Artis. You can, can't you?
I am somewhat home.
Yes.
Not in Chipley, but Jacksonville, yes.
Yes, outstanding. Now, I tell you, it's been a while since I stood next to you one time in 1971. It was do you remember the Island Garden?
Sure I do, absolutely.
in West Hempstead.
Right.
What a place that was. It was 1971, December 22nd, 1971. I had tickets. My father took me to the game. And all I remember is turning around and I looked into fur. And it was you. It was you with a black fur coat on.
Right.
And I looked up and it was Artis Gilmore. And yeah. I'll never forget that for the rest of my life. And I tell you, it's been worth the wait to get you on the show.
Well, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure and an honor talking about you and your great career, Artis, and the ABA. As I said, I relish those days with the ABA. Every kid had an ABA ball, bouncing it in the street and shooting it up for threes. And everybody wanted to be Artis Gilmore and Zelmo Beatty and Red Robbins and all the other guys in the ABA. And we thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk with us, Artis.
Well, my pleasure. My pleasure, Bill.
It's great. The great Artis Gilmore, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll hit the ice and we'll talk some Islander hockey with the great Stanley Cup winning Dave Langevin, folks. So please, stay with us.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WDBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. It's an exciting sports weekend in New York. The Rangers are awaiting the winner of the Islanders-Cap series. Big win for the Isles on Saturday afternoon at the Coliseum. They need to come up huge tomorrow night down in D.C. We have Subway Series baseball as we speak up in the Bronx right now. 2-0 New York Mets. Arrogant Yankee fans, please sit down. Take a seat. Take a seat. Well, my next guest, he played his amateur career at the University of Minnesota Duluth and went on to play for the Edmonton Oilers, the New York Islanders, the Minnesota North Stars, and the Los Angeles Kings during his professional career. Saw him win 4 consecutive Stanley Cups during the dynastic period of the New York Islanders that we're very familiar with. He's a member of the United States Hockey Hall of Fame. I welcome into Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Dave Langevin. Dave, good evening.
Hello, Bill. How you doing?
Great. Having a good evening tonight. Having a good one. Mets are winning 2-0.
Well, the Twins are losing, so I guess it's pretty dismal here with the Minnesota Twins. So I'd rather talk about them.
Yeah, the Twins haven't been doing too well, I've been hearing. Yeah, can't win them all.
It's been a long time. They went to their new building, and great expectations were made, and they haven't come to fruition yet. But there's still time. They got some young kids, and hopefully it'll turn around.
Hopefully, yes, sir. Well, growing up in Minnesota, Dave, who did you root for as a kid? Any favorite players, favorite teams?
Well, it was kind of funny. We didn't get the NHL team until 1967.
Yeah.
So until that point, I really didn't. We just went out in the backyard and played, and we didn't really have much influence from the Canadian hockey. I think Northern Minnesota had Let's Play Hockey, but we had a minor league team in the early 60s. The St. Paul Saints was a minor league for the NHL. I watched a few of those games, but I would have to say the players I liked when the North Stars first came about, I liked Moose Vasco.
Uh-huh.
He was a big defenseman that just went and hurt people. good defensively, and he was a good player. And then there was Bill Goldsworthy, who was a
great
goal scorer. Just a fiery guy on the ice. So those were kind of the guys I really liked. And I didn't know if I want to emulate them because at that time there weren't many NHL teams. And for me to think I was going to go in the NHL was really something that I never really thought of.
Exactly.
Really, for an American kid at that time, I think you just tried to get to play in a Division I college team.
I see. Okay. Now, what people may not realize, Dave, is that there was life before the Islanders for you. You played for the WHA Edmonton Oilers. You played for the great Bep Gwydolyn. You played for Glenn Sather. You played with guys like Bob Nevin, who was the captain of the New York Rangers at one time. Cowboy Bill Flett, Norm Ullman. Tell us a little bit about the Edmonton Oilers days.
Well, at that time it was, Bep Gwydolyn. I cannot say enough for him because here I am, a kid coming out of college. I had no idea what I was getting into, and he took me under his wing. He was. He let me play. He counseled me. He gave me a great opportunity, and he was probably one of the biggest reasons I got going is because, he gave me a chance to, go through the rookie thing. But he was very supportive, and he let me play. At that time, it was kind of the WHA and the NHL. Most of the WHA comprised of a lot of really young kids that thought, well, I'd rather go play in the WHA than go on an NHL minor league team.
Uh-huh.
And then we had a lot of 30-plus NHL players that, maybe at the end of their career, they could prolong it and play a little longer. So we got a lot of those players that came over. And, Norm Ullman, oh, my God, what could you say about that guy? One of the classiest people you could ever meet. And, so those are the kind of people that I had. They influenced me. And then we had Glenn Sather came.
Mm-hmm.
He was a player. I played with him for a couple of years. And then he rose to become the coach and general manager of the Edmonton Oilers. And I imagine he's still the same feisty person he was back then. And it's kind of funny. Yeah, I've talked to Glenn a couple of times over the past couple of years. We're talking about players in Minnesota here. And, he seems the same. And, you know, he built the Edmonton Oilers, and it carried over to where he's at with the Rangers.
Yeah, I bet. Now, when the Oilers joined the NHL, the Islanders reclaimed you.
Correct.
Now, you played for Al Arbor, who was a defenseman during his career. Tell us about the impact that Al had on your career, Dave.
Well, I think it's Al, it was a great impact. I've had a lot, you know, it's usually a bunch of people. I had some great coaches on the way, but it just seems like when I got to Al, he put it all together. You know, I had a great coach in high school, Andre Ballou, who was a he was a scout with the Rangers, and he also was one of the coaches with the North Stars. I had him, and then I would have to say Glenn Sather had a good influence. He was, I think, his influence. Andre kind of taught us how to work hard. You know, he just would, every practice was very difficult and hard, and he expected a lot. Glenn was kind of a coach that was very emotional. He got you up every game and got you fired up. And then I would have to say, you know, Al Arbor kind of put the two together with the motivation and the hard work and also the discipline, which I think was one of the greatest. I think for that time, for the team, the Islanders were very disciplined. I think I can remember Al would say, he'd stand in the middle of the room, he says, I don't care if the roof falls in. We just keep playing the same way. And I think that's what was our... The key to our success is we could be down by two, up by two. We'd play the same, and we just wore teams down. Yeah, he was a fair coach. I think another thing that he really brought to all of us is that he treated us all the same. I think that can be a big detriment to a team if there's favoritism showed. And I think it was through the whole organization, I think, with Bill. He built a great, you know, getting a guy like Al Arbor. He had Jim Devolano, and he had himself, you know, with those three people. You know, there was a lot of great people to help build that organization. And I think the three things that, you know, another thing that they brought up is that they made all of us, each one of us players, feel important. You know, you could always, you know, it's not hard to give a lot of attention to Bossy Trotche and Dennis Potvin and Billy Smith. You know, you could always say, oh, my God, this, that, and the other thing. But about those guys, you know, they are great players, and they were a great foundation for a championship. But those guys couldn't have won it alone.
No.
And I think that was the greatest thing is after those three, four, top four so-called superstars on the team, there was a pretty good supporting cast after that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Now, looking at the first Stanley Cup, Dave, we're speaking to Dave Langevin tonight on Sports Talk 1240. The architect Torrey sends Billy Harris, who was a lifetime Islander, and Dave Lewis to the Kings for Butchie Goring. Now, during the telecast the other night, he called you the quintessential defenseman who always finished his checks, which I thought was a great line. Tell us a little bit about Goring now, the missing piece of the puzzle of who people call Butchie. Talk about Butch.
Yeah, Butch. He was some of the things that led up to the Butch Goring thing was I think I came in with the – it was probably one of the – probably the worst times that I could have come in as a player. The Islanders won the overall points for the league. And then he lost to the Rangers, and it was a very different atmosphere when I came in there because you know the players were still hurting from losing to the Rangers after you know their expectation was to win the Stanley Cup, and I think the Islanders at that time they made a few changes. You know, Butch Goring was a big one. You know, we also brought in Gord Lane.
Right.
We also brought in Dwayne Sutter, and. Let's see, Anders Kaller came in, and then another addition that came back was John Potvin. So you kind of see in that they needed to tweak some things and to try to have more depth on defense. I think with myself and Gord Lane, you got more physicality back there. And then we had Bob Lorimer was back there too. So we had a pretty solid, and Dave Lewis was there also. So it was kind of a, you know, the defense. And you know, was pretty solid at that time. Was just, you know, we're all getting back together and trying to get over that loss to the Rangers. So then, you know, kind of, I think another thing that was a problem for the Islanders in the playoffs the previous year, I think, was the Rangers, and then the year before it was Toronto, is the Islanders had one line that pretty much, you know, if you stop them, you stop the Islanders. What Butch Goring brought was brought us another line.
Right.
That, if you tried to stop Trotz and Boss, you know, we had Butch's line picked up, Butch with Clark Gillies and Dwayne Sutter. So that line picked it up. And then our third line become, you know, it just became stronger because the second line centerman, I think it was Lauren Henning, at that time was moved down to the third line, and he was with Nystrom and Tonelli.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing Butch in, we went from a one-line guaranteed goal-scoring team to now we had three very good lines that, you know, it's going to be difficult to stop. And even our fourth line was good. We had, like, Wayne Merrick and Anders Kaller. You know, so those guys are the ones, I think, basically that the lines that won us the Stanley Cup, you think it's your first line, but our third and fourth line probably got most of the key goals in the Stanley Cup playoff run, you know, because the other teams, were to, you know, they try to five-on-five, you know, try to stop Trotz and Boss. And then when they did that, the other guys picked up the slack. So I think Butch Goring brought a, you know, that extra line mate. And then, you know, what also was nice is, you know, when we've had all that depth, you know, it seems like we had a, you could make trades because we had a lot of depth on defense. We gave Dave Lewis with Harris. And then, you know, it also helped the final piece, I think, that gave us more depth on defense is when we got Kenny. So there was probably about five, six guys from the previous year that came in and got the team to where I think they were comfortable, you know, going into the playoffs. Because after Butch, I think we went undefeated like 13 games.
Yeah.
So I think we were all revved up and ready to go.
Now, one of the other guys on the club could be considered the Coliseum crowd, Dave. We're speaking of Dave Langevin tonight. And as we can see during the last playoff series, the crowds played a big part in rooting on the club. How do you feel the crowd played a part in the playoff run during your club's time? And how do you feel about the team leaving the Coliseum now?
Well, my wife and I, Deb, we still talk about, you know, after games, walking out in a parking lot. You know, and there's people, I don't even know if they do that anymore, the players walk out. And there's a line of people every game.
Yeah.
You know, we'd walk out there, we'd shake hands, we'd sign autographs. And it was, you know, it's a big place, Long Island, but I think just the fans for the Islanders, I want to sound corny, but I think there was a love between the players and the fans because, you know, it just, it was their team. You know, it was they saw it come from nothing to becoming a potentially a Stanley Cup team. And I think, you know, even today I get letters from the fans and, you know, people that are back then, you know, they're in high school or they're older people and they just, the impact of our team on them when they were younger. And, you know, I can just say equally as well, the impact of the fans on me is, you know, something you never forget.
It's sort of like the Mets, Dave. It wasn't a long time between 1962 and a world championship, and it wasn't a long time between the Islanders winning 12 games and winning a Stanley Cup. It wasn't
a big
stretch of time.
Yeah, it's. I think that's what makes it so special is, you know, you can, the rise from mediocrity to a dynasty, you know, was within, you know, reach of a lot of people's, you know, their lifetime, 10 years, you know, you could just see the team getting better and better. And then, you know, again, that comes down to it all comes down to ownership. It starts with ownership. Because the ownership is willing to get the right people in there. And then you get Bill Torrey, and then Bill Torrey brings in Jim Devolano, and then Devolano brings and Bill bring in Al Arbor. And, I think, the sad thing is, if people want to figure out how to win a Stanley Cup, they should have followed the Islander, the model of building a team, because it was so successful. And even today, it would be a good model to build a team. You asked me about the team moving. I guess I got to be nice about this.
Well, you don't work for. I asked Kenny Morrow, and he had to take the company line. You don't have to do that.
Well, I just think it's a travesty.
Yeah.
I just think it's something the NHL should have never allowed.
Right.
It's the thing is, it was a match between the ownership and the county.
Right.
And there was no regard whatsoever for the fans.
Right.
And the history of the Islanders.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like ever since the Islanders won, I hate to say it, but probably the best guy that should have been an owner for the Islanders since Pickett sold would have been Spanos. Maybe he didn't have any money, but I'll tell you, that guy loved the Islanders.
Mm-hmm.
I went back and read things. He wrote about, his just love for the team. He loved where the team came from, and he had where he wanted it to go. And there was talk of possibly having Dennis Potvin as the president. And then, bringing in some of the guys that lived through the Islander time, how to build and how it became to where it was, where it became from the beginning to where it got to the championship.
Yeah.
And it seems like after Pickett sold it, every owner that was there is trying to erase that history.
Yeah, they finally tried to embrace it this year, but it was kind of too late, too much, too little, too late.
Well, the thing is, I keep hearing that we're going to have a state of the art arena in Brooklyn. Okay, was there about 5,000 seats you can't even see the game in?
Yeah, it doesn't have the sight lines that the Coliseum has. It's not built for hockey.
Okay, so what's so state-of-the-art in that? And also,
yeah,
what size is the rink in Nassau County and the size of the rink that's going to be in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
200 by 85.
Yeah.
That's all that matters, what is on that ice. And finally, after how many years, they finally, maybe with the new ownership, because I think they're more interested in putting the product on the ice than trying to build a parking lot.
Yeah.
And it shows. If they would have had this team 10 years ago, they would have got that rink. There's no doubt about it, because I'll tell you, when the team is winning, things seem to be, you get more things. Well, when we won, we got the inside fixed up. We finally got our locker room fixed. But you know what? I don't think you can't blame players. You can't blame fans. Most of this happens because of things out of the fans' and players' controls. But I still think the NHL shouldn't have let him in. Excuse me, shouldn't have let this, somebody should have mediated and tried to figure this out. But here's another thought is, I think doesn't the owner of the Barclays Center own the Coliseum?
Now they're involved in it, yeah.
Well, maybe what this is just a 2-3 year renovation project for the Coliseum, and the Islanders have a place to play until that's done.
Now, Bettman,
that's my hope.
Bettman has said, "Don't count on them coming back."
Well, it's up to the owners and probably the if the same people own the both rinks. But he's got to say that, because right now they got a lease. But you know what?
Yeah.
All the Islanders have in control now is to go beat Washington tomorrow.
That's what we have to worry about, Dave.
Yeah, that's the only thing that anybody has. That's the only thing anybody has control over is tomorrow. And if they do that, I think everything else will take care of itself at some point.
We're talking to Dave Langevin tonight on Sports Talk 1240. And then what may lay ahead is the Rangers. Speaking about that, coming from one of your runs was the all-important 1940 chant that we know and love developing from one of the runs. Now, we may be on the verge, as we said, of another series with the Rangers. Talk a little bit about the rivalry with the Rangers, what it meant to you and to your club and to your bunch of guys, Dave.
Well, I remember when we first I got there in 79-80 season, it was kind of a strange thing that when we played the Rangers, we'd score, everybody'd stand up and scream. When the Rangers scored, everybody would stand up and scream. So it was kind of because at that time the Rangers were the team. You know, they had a lot of success. They've been there forever. And every fan probably on the island was a Ranger fan. But I think as we started winning Stanley Cups, we got our own identity. We had our own bragging rights. And I think that was probably the biggest thing is you didn't want to lose to the Rangers because you'd never stop hearing about it. You know, because,
yeah.
You know, you got fans that they're with you win or tie. And, you know, they'll, you know, it's easy to jump on you when, you know, the Rangers fan. I just think it's a great rivalry. You know, like you said, it's everybody's in the same neighborhood and bragging rights for the area. And plus, you know, it's the next step for the Islanders to move on if they get past Washington. So mm-hmm. it could be we're in the same situation again. I think the Islanders are trying to build something, move up, go to the next level. And, you know, I think I think they'll beat Washington tomorrow. It'd be very interesting to watch the Rangers Islanders. It'd bring back a lot of memories because those games were pretty intense. And I've even, you know, being in Minnesota, I used to talk with Herb Brooks and I used to tell him and we'd talk about our series. And I just, well, if the Islanders weren't there, you guys probably would have won Stanley Cups.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what hurt these guys most is they said, you know, if the Islanders weren't here, we were good enough to win. But, you know, right now I think the Rangers are, you know, they got a good opportunity ahead of them too.
They definitely
do. You only get so many chances.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's difficult with free agency and salary caps. You know, you can only probably keep a team together for so long before it just starts dismantling itself.
Looking at the drive for five, Dave, you had no problem with Edmonton the first time around. You swept them. And in 83-84, when Edmonton beat you, what was the difference in that series when going up against Edmonton?
The one before that where we won four straight against Edmonton,
yeah,
that was probably one of our most difficult series. I think Billy Smith had a lot to do with that, where we won four in a row. I think he was Conn Smythe for that one. He played exceptional, and Edmonton was just learning how to win. I think they thought that they could just go in there and dance around and be fancy and it'll just come to them because I think they had a pretty easy run through the playoffs.
They did. They got most of the press because Gretzky was hot all year. He won.
Oh, yeah.
He broke most of the scoring records, and they came in getting most of the accolades. But the Islanders swept them 4-0.
Yeah, I think that. Well, I think the thing is, every year we won, we were the team not to beat.
Right.
It just seems like we never got that respect. I think everybody's getting tired of us being there, so they're trying to hope somebody else would knock us off. But every year it was just like, oh, this team's going to beat us. This team's going to beat us. One year was St. Louis was going to win, and we just destroyed them. And then the thing with Edmonton, you know, I'm sure you're the same. You've heard about what Wayne Gretzky said after we beat them four straight is he walked by our locker room, and we had ice bags and knee braces and those guys, cuts all over our face. And we were banged up, and they're walking out of the locker room, and they didn't have a scratch on their face.
Right.
The thing is, you know, it's not an easy.
That's
not
that,
easy
that's when
to
they
win
saw.
The Stanley Cup.
Yeah, him and Messier said that. That's how when we saw how tough it is to win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, and I think they learned that lesson because the next year they were a different team. You got to remember, that when they, I think when we lost the fifth one, I just think we ran out of steam. You know, we were just, you go 5 years to the finals, and then during that time we had, I think there was like three Canadian Cups series where we played in the summer. We just played a lot of hockey. I think in those five years we played like almost 6.5 years of hockey. You really don't get a chance to rest, and not making excuses, but I just think it was probably the Oilers' turn.
Yeah.
You know, and plus I think another thing that wasn't a good factor for us is a lot of our draft choices, our first round draft choices, didn't really pan out. You know, to come in and just help rejuvenate us and get us going, because we didn't really until our, I think when we lost the fifth, Flatley and LaFontaine showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And but still, that was just 1 year where maybe if we would have had three or four younger other guys just in there, you know, carrying the load for some of us guys that have been there for a long time, kind of beat up and kind of worn out a little bit, it may have been different. But I just, you know, how could you? Edmonton is, after us, is probably another great team, you know, that in history, you know, they just, they had it all too. They helped change the game with their speed and their puck moving ability. But I think that was difficult. You know, when you're 4 years in a row owning the cup and you lose it, you know, it's difficult. That's,
yeah.
You know, even watching it today, I can't watch another team carry the cup around the rink because I still think it's mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I says, well, why are you borrowing that from us? That's ours. And, you know, the thing is, it's sometimes it's not the ones that you win that you remember. It's the one that you lost that probably sticks with you the most. You keep going over it. Well, what could we have done? Could we have done something differently? Because, you know, it wasn't really until the last game, you know, where they just kind of rolled over us, the winning game. But, you know, you always think, well, geez, if we would have, you know, I think the biggest thing that hurt us is we didn't win at home on the first game.
Right.
And that's when every year that we had our run, they changed the playoff format.
Yeah, that's what Bossy had brought up, the schedule format. Well, we remember the ones that you won, Dave. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, once in a while you just go back. But, oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, just, you know, my heart's still in Long Island with the fans. I just feel terrible for the fans. And watching the games on TV, I don't know, there's nothing wrong with that rink. You know, it's still, you know.
The barn still rocks. Don't worry, Dave.
It's still, well, we went back for a reunion a couple years ago. It still smells the same. The stale beer.
Well, I tell you, Dave, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight talking Islander hockey about your career. I thank you for taking part out of your Sunday night to be with us.
No problem, and I'll do it tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Dave Langevin, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Artis Gilmore and Dave Langevin, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Derek Wozniak and John Sweeney up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday, May 10th, with Brooklyn Dodger legend Carl Erskine and Hall of Famer Tommy Lasorda. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.